Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Sam. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Metastatic Breast Cancer. And today's program is a part two of a two-part series, and it's called Managing the Challenging Side Effects of Metastatic Breast Cancer Treatments. Now, this two-part series has been offered during Breast Cancer Awareness Month for the metastatic breast cancer community, and we really wanted to acknowledge and recognize the needs of the metastatic community by doing this program, and really we're covering a lot today. This is a very ambitious program, and we hope that you'll walk away with lots of information from this program. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have over 884 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Canada, Kenya, Korea, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a credit to you that you're on the program today to really learn some information that might be helpful to you, tools that will help you in coping with and dealing with a metastatic breast cancer. Now, today's program was made possible by an unrestricted educational grant from Novartis Oncology and also made possible with support from ICI Oncology, and I really want to thank them both for their support, for their really collaborative support in supporting the program today. Now, we have just wonderful speakers on the program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Lydia Shapira. Dr. Shapira is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. She's Staff Oncologist, Gillette Center for Breast Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Shapira is going to present an overview of metastatic breast cancer, and we'll also talk about how to take care of your bones with treatments, and the role of clinical trials, and practical tips to cope with memory and thinking changes, or chemo brain. I'm going to turn this program over to Dr. Shapira, who has a very ambitious number of topics to cover. Dr. Shapira.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be with all of you, and I've actually taken some notes because even I sometimes have memory issues. So I will read from my notes a little bit. The first thing I'd like to just tell you is that metastatic breast cancer is a series of illnesses. Perhaps there is no one clinical syndrome or that is the same. So people with metastatic breast cancer can have problems related to the kind of cancer they have or the location of the tumors. First, let's start by defining it. Metastatic breast cancer refers to cancer that has spread from the breast, started in the breast, but is now located in other organs. And often the kinds of problems that women experience with this disease depend a little bit on how much cancer there is and where it is located. There often needs to be a biopsy to confirm the fact that it is metastatic breast cancer. And these days, we're also encouraging many of our patients who develop these metastases, often many years after their original diagnosis, to have these metastases biopsied, or at least one site biopsied, to make sure that it is that disease and also to recheck the receptors. The receptors, typically, by that we mean that we test the estrogen progesterone receptor to try to determine if the cancer will respond to hormonal or endocrine treatment. And we also look for HER2, which, as you know, is overexpressed or expressed in larger than normal amounts in about 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 women with breast cancer. Based on this information, then we can come up with a treatment plan that makes sense for that woman at that particular point in time. Treating metastatic breast cancer may include a variety of different treatments, hormonal therapies or endocrine therapies, sometimes chemotherapy, radiation that may be targeted to treat a particular problem, even surgery, and very often now, and increasingly so, some targeted and novel therapies, some of which are already available for standard treatment and some are only available through clinical trials. So typically, a woman who has metastatic breast cancer will have a variety or a series of successive treatments. And many of my patients often ask, well, how long will I be treated for? It's very hard to give a precise answer to that question because unlike the first time one is diagnosed, when perhaps there can be a very organized treatment plan, in the metastatic setting, we often treat as long as the treatment is working and as long as it is well tolerated. Treatments often change. They change because the disease becomes resistant. So it's important to keep thinking that whatever treatment you may be on now will need to be modified. And perhaps if you are living with this disease, that you'll need to be on some form of treatment forever. We know that treatment is working because it either relieves a symptom or we can get some objective evidence that it's working through scans, sometimes through blood tests. We use a variety of different methods to really find out if it's the right treatment. We want to make sure that the patient, in this case, woman with metastatic breast cancer, feels as well as she can feel, that the side effects of the treatment are acceptable to her. And we also want signs that it's working by reducing the size of tumors that we see on different scans or x-rays and making sure that all of the blood tests indicate that she is safe. Now you might think, how do we decide when to change treatment and what comes next or what particular order of treatment? And that is often what you need to discuss with your particular oncologist based on where the disease is, what treatments you've had, and what the biology is like. Hormonal therapies, we try as long as we possibly can for women who have hormonally sensitive tumors, but eventually we need to change over and try other ways of perhaps overcoming resistance to hormonal therapy or even considering chemotherapy. Women who have triple negative tumors, tumors that are not hormonally sensitive and don't have HER2 overexpression, typically are prescribed chemotherapy. And women who have HER2-driven cancers usually are prescribed some form of anti-HER2 therapy, either alone or in combination with chemotherapy. So let me now turn to bones and just mention a little bit about bone therapy. There are a variety of bone-modifying agents, and they are incredibly helpful in metastatic breast cancer in delaying the time to any painful bone-related event, such as a fracture. Breast cancer can often destroy the bones and cause painful symptoms from involvement in bone. So these drugs, and there are three that we commonly use, one is called zoledronic acid, the other is pomidronate, and the newest one is denosumab, are helpful in treating these bone metastases and preventing the bones from breaking. Zometa, or zoledronic acid, and pomidronate can have some serious side effects, and the one that almost everybody has heard of is that it can cause this very rare but very debilitating syndrome of osteonecrosis of the jaw. So it happens rarely, but it can be quite debilitating. It can also affect the function of the kidney, so it has to be dosed very carefully. This newest drug, denosumab, has the advantage that it can be given just under the skin, so you don't need to have an IV placed, and it doesn't affect the kidney function, and it works slightly differently. In fact, it's a monoclonal antibody that affects the proteins of some cells that live in the bone called osteoclasts, which are really important in modeling and shaping bone. So many women who have metastatic breast cancer are taking some form of bone-modifying therapy in addition to their anti-tumor therapy, which could be hormonal or some form of targeted therapy or chemotherapy. Now, that doesn't mean that all women with metastatic breast cancer need to be on these drugs. This is something that has to be decided on an individual basis. So let me turn now and say just a few words about the role of clinical trials. Clinical trials are research studies that we use to answer important questions. We use it to advance our knowledge, and the main objective of doing clinical trials is to advance the options for future patients. Of course, we hope that patients who are participating will also derive some personal benefit, but the real intention of these clinical trials is just to advance our knowledge. there are very structured ways of conducting research, and we often refer to this as the phases of clinical trials. In phase one, we try to figure out how much of a new treatment can be given with reasonable safety, how much can be given at a given time, how does the body handle the drug. For phase two, we try to determine if the new treatment works for specific cancer types. We try to gather data on effectiveness. So we already have learned something about whether or not the body can handle it, and then we try to figure out if it helps. And finally, the studies in phase three try to answer the question, is the new treatment better than the standard treatment for a specific type of cancer, in this case, breast cancer? And what's interesting about phase three is that it involves a randomization, which means that neither the patient nor the physician choose what treatment they get, as a way of really testing whether it is the innovation, the new drug, that makes a difference, if in fact a difference is found. So it's important to think about clinical trials, especially in the metastatic setting, because there may be some new drugs which offer some hope, perhaps because they work through a different mechanism of action. And it's certainly possible at times to participate in these trials and feel that you're making a contribution to progress, in addition perhaps and hopefully to deriving some sort of a personal benefit. But it's important to ask if it's the right thing for you, if this is the right time to take some risks. Remember that if a medication is new, we may not know everything about it and may not be able to handle or answer all of your questions with the type of certainty or precision that you want. So you might want to ask yourself, you know, a few questions about it, and also go in prepared so that you know what kind of questions you want to ask the trial team. Will there be extra trips, perhaps, to the doctor or to the center? What will happen if you have some complications as a result of getting these new drugs? And how will my privacy be protected? How will the research be supervised? All of these things are very important questions that you should have, you should ask, and hopefully after having some good conversations, you'll decide if participating in a trial is right for you or not. There are many different kinds of trials going on, mostly at major cancer centers, some in the community as well. So discussing this with your oncologist is really important. And perhaps one way to start the conversation is just to say, am I eligible for a study? Meaning, do I meet the criteria for participating in a study? And if so, what kind of studies are going on for people like me? So think about that as you have conversations with your doctor, even at a time when things are going well, because one of the things that I think is really helpful is if you're prepared and think, well, perhaps it's working well now, but what will be the next step? What will I want to do? And if you're prepared, perhaps it'll be easier and less unsettling and less anxiety-provoking to make the next decision. Let me turn now to my final topic, which is how to cope with one of the scariest, perhaps, side effects of cancer treatment, and that is this chemo brain, the idea that, or the syndrome that so many patients described of being unable to focus, having trouble with finding some words sometimes finding trouble, having trouble perhaps with visual and spatial memory, so that may make reading a map difficult, perhaps forgetting things. These things are pretty common among women who are living with metastatic disease and getting treatment. Sometimes it's hard to know if it's just because they may be distracted and anxious. Sometimes we think that there are real effects of the treatment, and the combination of having had some drugs and perhaps some hormonal treatments and perhaps also being a little bit distracted can make thinking and organizing and focus very hard. So there is, again, no one particular medication that will cause this. We've heard this for many women who've had many different treatments. Some get better, and some have to live with some degree of this memory loss. What kind of things can I recommend for you? Well, the first thing is to try to deal with the anxiety and the distraction by trying to do some relaxation exercises and try to channel the power of your own mind so you're calm and you think as clearly as possible. Another is to make lists, to keep a notebook to make sure that you have a record of all of your appointments and that you perhaps enlist the help of a friend or a relative to remind you of important things. So anything that you can do to jog your memory through puzzles, reading complicated books or newspapers, and having some good records, having a way of organizing your appointment and making sure that if you are going to go, for instance, into an important meeting or have an important conversation with your healthcare team to decide on next steps, that you take notes and that you take somebody with you who can also take notes and help you debrief. So with that, I'd like to turn this back to you, Carolyn, and look forward to hearing from the next speaker.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Shapiro, for such a comprehensive overview of metastatic disease and covering these very important topics and so fully. So thank you, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Julie Silver, and Dr. Silver is Assistant Professor, Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Silver is going to address strategies to cope with aches, pains, and neuropathy, medical and rehabilitation management of neuropathy, treatment-related weight changes and how to cope with them, and nutrition and physical activity guidelines. And I should say that Dr. Silver is a doctor of rehabilitation medicine and brings that whole perspective as well to addressing these topics. And it's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Silver.
Thank you, Carolyn. Well, that was a great overview of metastatic cancer, and I want to really focus on how you can function at the highest possible level. And that's actually what rehab doctors do. We're called physiatrists, and we have this saying called focus on function. And in order to focus on function, one thing that we really, really care a lot about is the day-to-day things that people are doing. And you probably have heard of that thing called ADLs, Activities of Daily Living, but that's really kind of the most basic type of thing that you do to function. That's like getting dressed and bathing and so on. As rehab doctors, we want to really focus on higher level skills too. We want to make sure that you're able to function out in the community, that you can do all the things that you want to do if you're able to, and to not accept the, quote, new normal, unquote, if you don't need to. So let's start with just thinking about this idea between impairment and disability. Impairments are the things that we find on physical examination. And a good example is if you had a leg amputation, for example, the missing part of the leg, that would be the impairment. But if you couldn't walk because you didn't have a prosthesis, that would be the disability. If you put a prosthesis on someone and then they can walk, now they have a lot less disability. So you didn't change the impairment because their leg is still amputated, but all of a sudden you dramatically change their level of disability. And that's one of the things I really want you to keep in mind as we go on, is that you can, even sometimes when you can't change the underlying diagnosis, you can dramatically change someone's ability to function. You can really improve their level of disability. So when it comes to neuropathy, that's often true. Especially if you have metastatic cancer and you're getting different types of treatments, the neuropathy may not, the nerves may not actually improve in terms of how they're functioning. But the way that you function overall can actually improve dramatically. And there's a bunch of different ways that you can approach this. One is medications, and you certainly can talk to your doctor about medications. Medications are used to treat neuropathy, and they may work for you. You need to talk to your doctor about that. There are oral types of medications and also topical types of medications, creams, that can be used with neuropathy. Another thing that may work with neuropathy is to try to decrease some of the stress, especially on your hands and feet, because that's that often sort of exacerbates the symptoms or makes the symptoms worse. So, for example, if you want to think about your feet, you might want to try stress mats that you stand on instead of standing on the hard kitchen floor or the place at work. For your hands, you may want to think about using a smartphone and a voice-activated email, or the GPS that I used this morning actually was voice-activated. So all this new technology that's so good for everything, that can really decrease some of the stress on your hands. You might have heard of the Good Grips-type tools, the larger-handled tools. So if you have a larger handle on a tool, you're going to have to use less strength and you'll decrease the stress that you have to place. So these are all just kind of ideas about ways that you can actually function at a higher level and decrease your disability. A really good way to find out about all the different strategies is to see a rehabilitation specialist, and for a lot of the kinds of problems that neuropathy causes, I would recommend seeing an occupational therapist. An occupational therapist, one visit with an OT can often really dramatically change your life. It can help you dress faster. It can help you work faster. It can help you with all kinds of different things in terms of function. Another thing that sometimes people use is called a TENS unit, transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation, and sometimes people will use sort of something to distract them, and TENS is something that distracts them, and that's something to talk again with your doctor about in terms of the neuropathy. One thing I want to say about neuropathy, too, is that, and pain in general, whether it's from neuropathy or not, sometimes the pain is actually causing the disability and not whatever is coming from the pain or what's causing the pain. So, for example, if you have metastatic disease to your spine, you may be having some pain from that. And if that pain is not treated and you're kind of worried about it, you may be starting to limit what you're doing. So you may be starting to get really worried, and all of a sudden you find that your world is shrinking. What I often ask my patients is to kind of think about their world, like how far do they go? Do they go to the grocery store still? Do they go to the mall? Have they been out of state recently? You know, sort of how big is their world? And frequently what I find is patients get more worried and they start thinking about things, and their pain makes them nervous and so on, and they start shrinking their world. And pretty soon, a lot of times, their world is sort of just around their house or maybe just to their house and to the doctor. So I really try to help my patients have a bigger world and to get out and to do more things. And pain is one of those things that we really want to manage well so that the pain itself is not causing your disability, or the fear of having pain. So fear can cause disability too. If you're worried about having pain, then you stop because you're worried. That's causing disability. So very interesting relationships between impairments and disability and fear, and we want to really manage all of that. Sometimes we call those cluster symptoms, when you see things come in a cluster, and you have to manage all of them, not just one of them. And your doctor really should help you with that. I want to switch gears and talk about treatment-related weight changes. And this is a big topic, and I know that people get so nervous about whatever they eat, and they think, oh, my gosh, I just had a cup of soy milk. Is that a disaster? Or I just ate a candy bar. Oh, that's terrible. And, you know, the thing about food is that nothing's really going to hurt you unless you have a whole lot of it and you really have it consistently over time. You know, if you have a glass of soy milk right now, that is not a disaster. If you go have a candy bar, that's not a disaster either. If you have a candy bar with every meal, well, that might be more of a problem for a lot of reasons. But certainly eating junk food constantly is not what I'm recommending. What I'm trying to focus on is not to obsess about food and not to think everything you put in your mouth is dangerous, because people get really nervous about that. So a quick tip, shop the perimeter of the grocery store where the healthier foods are. Try to keep as, when you think about ingredients, the fewer ingredients, the better. So if you eat an apple, that's a lot better for you than, for example, some sort of apple pie that has all kinds of different ingredients and so on. So the fewer ingredients, the better in general. And then I really want to just mention this idea about Exercise. Exercise is certainly good for you. What I try to get my patients to do is just think about, all right, how active am I now? I have them all put a pedometer on and just track their steps. For healthy people, 10,000 steps a day is the goal. But for people who are actively undergoing treatment or whatever, what I like to do is instead of saying you need to get to 10,000 steps, which may not even be a goal that's reasonable or realistic, I like to know where they're at now and then try to make an appropriate goal that's a little bit more than where they're at now. So if they're walking 2,000 steps a day on average, then maybe I'll say let's try to go up to 2,200 steps a day on average for a week or whatever. So I really like to know where they're at. The other thing that's really great to know is that there's this concept called energetics, which is really the balance between how active you are and what you're eating. So this energy balance. And that's really what's important is to kind of think about both of these things, not just diet and not just exercise, but the balance between them. And the more active you are, the more you're going to be converting some of your what we call adipose tissue or, you know, really fat to lean body mass. So a lot of times with women who have breast cancer, they might not change in weight, but if they are exercising, they'll increase their lean body mass, and that's good for you if you can increase your lean body mass. I didn't really talk too much about being underweight, and I'm going to actually triage that to the next speaker, Dr. Laprinzi, who will be talking about what happens when you're feeling very nauseous or you're vomiting and diarrhea and so on, and he'll cover more of that.
That's perfect. Thank you so much, Dr. Silva. It's a wonderful presentation and really very informative and on topics that everybody struggles with in the metastatic community. And it's just so excellent that you've covered them in such a thoughtful way and also as a physiatrist. So that brings a whole other perspective to the call as well. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Charles Laprinzi. Dr. Laprinzi is the Regents Professor of Breast Cancer Research, Mayo Clinic College of Medicine. Now, Dr. Laprinzi also has a very robust number of things to cover. He's going to cover all of the kind of side effects you often think about, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, and mouth sores. He's also going to address managing dental concerns, your teeth and gums during cancer treatments. And he's also going to address communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Laprinzi.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back talking here. I've been given a number of different symptoms to cover, and not a whole lot of time, but I'll try and get through what I can here. The first one was managing nausea and vomiting. Again, that could be talked about for quite a bit of length. There's nausea and vomiting that's related to chemotherapy, and we've had programs before on that. There are medications given to try to prevent the nausea and vomiting related to chemotherapy based on how much the chance of chemotherapy, how much the chance of the specific chemotherapy a person is going to get is going to cause nausea and vomiting. We use the Trons medications, ondansetron or granisetron or palonosetron, otherwise known as zofran-chytril and aloxi, and oftentimes we use another medication called a prepotent and also a steroid medication. And those can be tapered toward the different types of chemotherapy that people get. And most centers have guidelines to help direct that. If people get nausea and vomiting despite that first chemotherapy dose and the medications that are given to prevent it, then there can be medications can be given such as Compazine or Procalperazine or Haloperidol Haldol to help get people over that acute time, and it might be that the next time they get chemotherapy, their medications will be modified to hopefully be a bit better against causing the chemotherapy-induced neuropathy or chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. Radiation therapy also can cause nausea and vomiting, usually not so much in people with breast cancer who are getting radiation, but more so when people are getting radiation to the abdominal area, and the similar sort of medications can be used for that. Then again, when you have patients who have metastatic cancer, a lot of them will have trouble with nausea and vomiting, not related to chemotherapy or radiation. They might be related to some of the other medications people are taking or to some hormonal process that the cancer puts out. Using the Trons medications like the ondansetron or Zofran can be helpful to some degree. Using other medications like the Compazine and the haloperidol can be helpful. Sometimes steroids are used there, although long-term use of steroids have their own side effects, and so that's not very appealing for that. There is another drug called megestrol acetate, or Megace, that actually was shown in studies where they looked at this for treatment of weight loss to try to help people gain weight, and it does allow people to gain weight, that they had less nausea and vomiting with that drug than they had with the placebo drug. Let me move on to talk a little bit about diarrhea, because that's another one that's on my list. There are a lot of things that can cause diarrhea. When I think about patients with breast cancer and think about diarrhea, the thing that makes me that comes to mind first is the drug capecitabine or Xeloda. It's similar. It's an oral medication usually given for a week or 2 weeks at a time, depending on the dose that's used. And then people who are taking this medication usually have 1 week off. So they're on 1 week and off 1 week, or on 2 weeks at a lower dose and then off for 1 week. And that medication can have two main side effects, and that is that it can cause diarrhea, or it can cause something called hand-foot syndrome, where hands and feet can get red and then tender, and then the skin can peel. So when people get diarrhea from this medication, and again, the people who are getting this are usually not with the doctor right then because they're given a oral pill and they go home with it. But I tell my patients that if they get diarrhea, loose stools associated with this, then their job is to stop the medication first and then call the doctor second. Not the opposite way around, because they might call the doctor first and the doctor's, it's Friday afternoon and the doctor doesn't happen to get back to them till Monday, and if they keep on with the medication, they can get into marked trouble with that. So it's important to stop the medication if diarrhea comes about. In terms of treatment of it, Pepto-Bismol or Imodium, loperamide are medications that can be done to help try to counteract that particular problem. And the doctor, if the person gets a lot of trouble with diarrhea with this, the doctor will recognize that that's the appropriate dose of the patient, or a higher dose is not appropriate for that patient, and the next time around will decrease the dose. Constipation is another thing that's on the list of things that I'm supposed to talk about. And there are a lot of things that can cause constipation, including not enough activity and blockage of some parts of the bowel and those sort of thing. But the thing that comes most to mind is the use of narcotic medications, morphine-type medications or codeine, which are very helpful medications to try to keep a person as active as possible and as pain-free as possible. But one of the biggest side effects of those medications is constipation. It's to the point where generally when I start a patient on a narcotic medication, I do a lot of counseling with them and tell them that they should probably start taking something or have it quite ready, that if they're not having regular bowel movements and before they get really constipated, that they should start taking a medication to help them get a bowel movement every day or so. And there are two classes of medications I usually think about. One are Senna compounds, S-E-N-N-A. There's genetic Senna a person can buy. If they want to spend a little bit more money, they can get Sennacot, which is a brand name of Senna. And if they want to spend a little bit more than that, they can get Sennacot S, which is a brand name of Senna, and also has some colace-type medication in there. I think the regular Senna works as well, about as well as the other ones. You may need a dose that's higher than people take for other things and higher than what you'll see from these over-the-counter medications, and enough to allow the person to have a bowel movement once a day or so. And the more narcotic a person has taken, the more medication they need. And it's not unusual for patients of mine to have to take 8 to 10 Senna tablets a day in order for them to have the right bowel movement, right amount of bowel movement. If they take too much, it'll cause diarrhea, but you just need to titrate that process. The other possibility is something called polyethylene glycol, and that medication, it comes in a liquid form, and people can just take that. It's over-the-counter also, and they can just take that and titrate that to the point where they get control of their bowels. Mouth sores is another thing that's on the list of things I'm supposed to talk about. Chemotherapy can cause mouth sores in some patients. It depends on the drug that's given as to the chance that it'll cause mouth sores. Adriamycin is a frequent drug given, and it causes a little bit of trouble with mouth sores. 5-fluorouracil is a drug that is, again, similar to this capecitabine I talked about, but we used to give this intravenously. And when you give this intravenously once a week or every couple of weeks, or sometimes it's given for 5 days in a row or used to be given 5 days in a row, that people can get quite a bit of trouble with mucositis or mouth sores. Years ago, we were involved with a clinical trial, and the nurses came up with this idea that if you put ice chips in the mouth before you start the 5-FU, and these are snow cone type ice chips, and you replenish those with a little teaspoon, and you keep those in the mouth for 30 minutes, that's the time when there's a lot of 5-FU in the blood, that would cause decreased blood flow to the mouth, because there's vasoconstriction to decrease the amount of blood flow to go there when you have ice, and then that would actually decrease the amount of 5-FU that got to the mouth and decrease the mucositis. And in fact, it does decrease the mucositis by about 50%, and this has been shown in study after study after study and now recommended by guideline panels. Other things that can be done is salt and baking soda rinses several times a day, half a teaspoon of salt and half a teaspoon of baking soda in 8 ounces of water, and swish that around for about a minute and then spit out, and that can be soothing. There are some magic mouthwashes that people have that have some lidocaine or novocaine-type medication in them, and those are sometimes used. There's for people who are getting radiation therapy to the mouth area, and this doesn't apply to breast cancer much, but can be to patients who have head and neck cancers. There's a new medication that's going to be reported over the next few days, I think on the 29th of this month, of a medication that's been shown to be helpful for that particular problem. And then let me spend just a couple more moments on dental concerns, which were brought up for me to talk about too. And Dr. Shapira did a nice job of mentioning that this osteonecrosis of the jaw is something that's related to the bone medications, the medications that people also use for treatment of osteoporosis. Bisphosphonates is the general category name of them. And the way I remember this is osteonecrosis. Osteo deals with bones, and necrosis deals with death, and that both the bone and the jaw dies because the medication blocks the action of a cell that helps to chew up bone, so new cells can make new bone in that area and keep the bone healthy. And with the teeth being right by the jaw, then you can get bacteria in there, and without the bone turning over, then they can get this osteonecrosis. Many people going to the dentist they will ask them if they're on any of these Fosamax-type medications, Zoledronate, because this is a big problem with this. So the issue with that is if you're on these medications and get trouble with your jaw, you need to bring that to the attention of your physicians and or your dentist and make sure you brush and floss your teeth on a regular basis as can be. And let me stop at that time for going on.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. LaPrinzi. You really, yeoman's coverage of all of these topics. Thank you so much, and I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Christy Case, and Christy is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. She's a clinical coordinator for women's cancers at Cancer Care. And Ms. Case is going to address the free psychosocial services offered by Cancer Care, as well as addressing the metastatic breast cancer support groups that we offer. Ms. Case?
Thank you, Carolyn. So today I would like to just start by talking about the importance of having support when you're diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, and as Carolyn said, how Cancer Care and our services can be a part of your team. So as we've learned today from the workshop, there is a lot of information about metastatic breast cancer to take in, and sometimes it is difficult to understand what this means for you. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer, here today metastatic breast cancer, affects a person, family, partners, and friends. They are also trained to help people with cancer and their families tackle some of the problems that come along, such as the practical and financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustments, and the psychological impact. Adjusting to and coping with the diagnosis of metastatic breast cancer is an important part of your journey, and you do not have to face it alone. Cancer Care can help in many ways, such as our practical support and financial help. If needed, we can refer you to a variety of financial resources. Our emotional support services are provided in a variety of settings, such as telephone counseling, online and telephone support groups. We realize that cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by contacting a cancer care social worker for counseling or by joining a support group is a sign of strength. Through our counseling services, it can afford you the time to talk about what your individual needs are, your concerns, and what your questions may be. So counseling can help you explore the tools you need in order to cope with your diagnosis of metastatic breast cancer. And for many people with cancer, talking to a social worker relieves them from all the stress of holding it all inside and shielding their loved ones from their struggle. So Cancer Care offers a wide variety of support groups as well. In addition to offering support groups for people with cancer, we also offer the support groups for family members, partners, caregivers, and loved ones. Many people find being in a support group is a great way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or have similar problems. So some of the groups that may be of interest for you are our wonderful telephone and online groups for women with metastatic breast cancer. So individual counseling and support groups are also a safe place where you can talk about your concerns and fears. These connections can help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Feeling emotionally well can help you better deal with your diagnosis and the treatment that you face. All of our services are provided completely free of charge. We are always seeking people that are interested in our support services, so if you would like to join, you can call Cancer Care at our Hopeline number, 1-800-813-4673, or visit our website, which is cancercare.org, to look at more information. So in addition, as you know, our Connect Education workshops provide both disease-specific information, such as today's workshop, and workshops on coping with the physical and emotional impact of cancer. Our fact sheets and booklets are packed with up-to-date information on treatments and the latest coping strategies to help people diagnosed with cancer and those that care for them. These are just two additional tools that can help you. Again, all of these materials are provided completely free of charge. So please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are here to help you. I really thank you for your appreciation of listening today and your attention and just the opportunity to get to speak to all of you. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Christy. Wonderful presentation and also wonderful description of all the services that people can access from Cancer Care. So now we do have time for questions. We have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Sam to bring all of our speakers on board, and if you would explain to the audience how to queue up for questions, we will take as many questions as possible. And if we don't get to your question, I'll repeat this again at the end as well, we will advise you to go ahead and call Cancer Care at a 1-800-813-HOPE number so that our staff can then address your questions that you didn't get to ask. But let's see how many we can take now. Sam?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question at this time, please press star, then the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Our first question comes from Allison S. Your line is now open.
Hi, my name is Loretta. I'm a breast cancer stage 4 person, and I've been looking at Afinitor to take, and I wanted to know about managing, this is a new drug, the side effects of Afinitor.
Thank you for that question. Dr. Shapiro, could you address that in a general way? And then we would advise you, of course, to go back to your treating healthcare team and get more information. But Dr. Shapiro?
Sure. This drug is a new drug, as you mentioned, that is used to try to overcome hormonal resistance. So if your cancer is hormonally sensitive and you've tried a series of hormonal treatments, the addition of Afinitor may make a difference and may allow you to derive benefit from the hormonal therapy a little bit longer. I think that in general the drug is quite well tolerated, and I saw a recent update looking at the use in older women suggesting it is also relatively well tolerated, but it's not a walk in the park. I don't have a whole lot of personal experience. Maybe Dr. Loprinzi wants to address it, but I know there have been issues with some mucus mucositis and some other issues with fatigue and so on. But I personally don't have a whole lot of experience, so I will pass that on to my other colleagues.
Dr. Lipinski?
Yes, I can comment on that a bit. So it is a relatively new drug. I've used it a couple of times in patients, but nobody has a lot of experience for it in breast cancer. Occasionally, people can get some pneumonitis, which is some inflammation of the lung, which is you need to make sure your doctor hears about that, because that can cause the symptoms people can have with that is cough, shortness of breath, difficulty breathing, chest pain sort of thing. So that's something to be aware of, and that might mean, oh, golly, we need to stop this because this is causing a bad side effect. Doesn't happen that often, but need to be aware of that. Other than that, some fatigue, people can get some skin rash, and they can get some sores around the mouth. Those are the most common things that people get with that. Occasionally diarrhea also is on the list of things.
And then I wanted to know about Xgeva versus Zometa, the difference in the side effects in those two.
Okay. Thank you for that question. Thank you. And Dr. Shapira?
Sure. I'm happy to take that. So Xgeva refers to the denosumab, which is the medication that can be just given under the skin. It is not going to affect kidney function, but it can have some of the same, I believe, effect on bone in terms of osteonecrosis. It has a better profile in terms of quality of life because it can be given more quickly. It doesn't affect the kidney function, but again, it can have the same feared complication. Zoledronic acid or Zometa is given as a very quick intravenous infusion. It can produce some flu-like symptoms and a little fever, so a little bit of pain and aching and fever. I've had some patients also who've had some nausea with this drug, and they sort of don't feel well for a couple of days. Many of them have no such symptoms, but it can happen. And the things to bear in mind are, of course, the kidney function alteration and also the fact that it could cause the osteonecrosis of the jaw. In terms of how they work or how they protect you, they're both very effective, so I think that it depends on access to one or the other, but they're both good choices.
Thank you. And our next question?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Rosemary J. Your line is now open.
Yes, I wondered why the oncologist discourage you from going to a dentist while you're on chemo or drugs such as anastrozole.
Okay, thank you for that question. Dr. Lipinski, could you address this in a general way?
So I didn't catch the whole thing. There's something about anastrozole, but can somebody repeat the issue?
Could we have the caller repeat the question? I think it isn't totally clear. Thank you, Dr. Lipinski. It's true.
Yes. Why do the oncologists not want you to go to the dentist if you're on chemo or the drugs such as anastrozole?
Okay, to the dentist. Okay, so the reason that there should be some caution with going to the dentist when a person is on chemotherapy is that chemotherapy can cause low blood counts, and that can cause a person to be at more risk for infection. It can also cause low platelet counts, which can mean they can bleed a little bit more often, which isn't as common. So that if a person's on chemotherapy, we'd like them not to be having dental care when their blood counts are low, because there's a lot of bacteria in the mouth, and those could go through the rest of the body and increase the risk of infection from that. So that's with that medication. The other one we talked about was the zoledronate or Zometa that we worry about. If dentists have to cut into the bone of the jaw and they're in these medications that can cause this osteonecrosis, that can make the problem worse there. For anastrozole or Arimidex, I don't know of any indication why a person couldn't go to the dentist with that particular medication.
Is it advisable, Dr. Lipinski, for the oncologist and the dentist to be in touch with each other if someone's in the midst of treatment, or could you say a word about whether that is that often done, or is that possible to be done?
Yes, so if a person's getting chemotherapy and it's just routine dental care and that sort of stuff, my usual recommendation to the patient is, you know, why don't you wait till a time when you're not on chemotherapy, because it's just more routine things, the cleaning and that sort of stuff. If dental care is needed, there's a cavity or there's an abscess or there's something like that, then if it has to be done right now and then, you almost have to do it because of an infection or something like that with an abscess. But if there's a little bit of time, there's a leeway, something has to be done, there's a broken tooth and it should be fixed over the next month or so, then I would try to have the patient get the dental work soon before their next planned treatment. And I say that because usually the blood count should be fine then, the white blood cell should be count. I would check the white blood count and make sure it's appropriately normal so that they don't have increased risk of infection because of no white blood cells to fight off the infection, and then have them have the dental work and may or may not have to delay chemotherapy for a couple of days or longer because of the dental work sort of thing. So communication for those patients who need it.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much. And we have a question from one of our online participants, Gail. How reliable and valid is the CTC test, and how should it be used to make decisions about changing treatment? Dr. LaPrinzi, do you want to take that one, and do you also want to just define what the CTC test is?
The CTC test?
Circulating tumor cells?
Oh, circulating tumor cells. Oh, okay, all right. And so circulating tumor cells, that's not a test I actually use all that often, but I'm aware of it. And there is an increased ability over the last few years that people can, investigators can get a blood sample from a patient and do some sophisticated maneuvering of that to see if there are cancer cells that are circulating around through the blood. And if there are, then when they give chemotherapy, you can then check them afterwards. And if they have decreased, the circulating tumor cells have decreased, then in that situation, that's a good sign that the chemotherapy is working. If they haven't decreased, then that's a suggestion that the chemotherapy is not working so well. Some people use these. We at our institution don't use them a lot because we can have a pretty good feel for how the chemotherapy is working by talking to the patient and looking at other things. Lydia, what are your thoughts on this?
So we're pretty clear here. We're doing a lot of research on this, but we don't think it's ready yet to help us make clinical decisions. So we are very excited about studying it, but we are not using it to change treatment or make any clinical decisions.
But some people are.
Some
physicians are.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Okay. So that will take that information back to your treating team, and I hope this is helpful to you in thinking through your question. Thank you. Now we have another question from another one of our online participants, and from Eleanor. What would cause nerve pain in upper arm after years of breast surgery? Dr. Shapira, I'm going to ask everyone, Dr. Silver, Dr. LaPrinzi, and we're going to answer this question, Eleanor, in a general way, and we hope then you'll take this information, again, back to your treating healthcare team.
I think Dr. Silver should start on this one.
Excellent. Okay, thank you. Dr. Silver.
Sure, I'm happy to start. So one thing I think is really important, and that is to not self-diagnose. So I would say that even describing it as nerve pain, it may feel like that, and that's okay to call it nerve pain, but don't assume it's from a nerve. It may not be. And in fact, I was just with a patient who said, you know what, I just developed lymphedema. And I said to her, oh, really? You know, what are your symptoms? And she said, well, I have pain in my arm. And I said, do you have any swelling? And she said, no. And I said, well, that's exactly the opposite of lymphedema usually. Usually lymphedema is no pain, and you do have swelling. So you want to just be really careful about self-diagnosing. If it's truly nerve pain, it can be from the brachial plexus, which is a group of nerves that's sort of under your arm and across your chest. It could also be from your neck, and it can be from various treatments that you may have had. Radiation treatment can certainly cause this history of surgery in a certain area. Sometimes arthritis causes nerve pain. You've probably heard of lots of people that have pain in their neck and their arm just from arthritis and so on. A lot of times the pain is musculoskeletal, though, and it's more like rotator cuff impingement or pain from your rotator cuff. That's a group of four muscles with four tendons that attach and make the shoulder move. So that's another reason. And then sometimes pain is actually due to problems that are related to the cancer itself. And this all needs to be sorted out and to really understand what kind of pain someone's having, what's causing it, and then decide how to treat it.
Excellent. That's really very comprehensive. Does anyone want to add anything to that? Or?
I think that was perfect.
I think that
was
perfect.
Nice.
Very, so we hope this is helpful to you, Eleanor, and that you take it back to your team. And it's a very interesting point about self-diagnosing. That's an excellent concept, I think. Does anyone want to say more about that? Because I think often people do present with what they think is, well, do you want to say anything about that, any of you, or has it already been covered?
This is Julie Silver. I love the idea of patients really listening to the voice of their bodies and really paying attention and being able to tell the doctor, you know, this is what I'm experiencing. I really rely on my patients to tell me things. But at the same time, I try to discourage them a little bit from arriving at their own diagnoses, especially when they're finding things on the Internet. Frankly, a lot of my patients arrive at much more serious diagnoses than they really have. They think, you know, they immediately think the worst, when in fact it may not be that big of a problem at all. So, I like people to pay attention to what's going on, but not necessarily arrive at their own diagnoses.
I think those are good words. And you know, a situation like this in all of our minds could be related to breast cancer problem, but it could be related to things totally different from breast cancer.
Thank you so much. Well, we have another question from one of our online participants. It's actually a follow-up question from Eleanor. What is the lowest effective dosage of the loader a patient could take with good results? Now, that, again, I'm going to ask Dr. Lipinski to address it. But indeed, again, this is something that we'll have to go back to one's treating healthcare team. But is that something you can just comment on?
So what's the lowest effective dose? We don't usually think of it exactly like that, but let me speak to the issue. So this medication is like 5-fluorouracil, 5-FU. We used to give that by intravenous boluses. And then we found out that if you give it by a continuous infusion, have an IV in the arm and have a pump give it, like they oftentimes do for colorectal cancer, that it can work a little bit better against the cancer if there's a lot of some of the 5-FU in the bloodstream for two days or 10 days or a week, 2 weeks, something like that. And the oral capecitabine is a way to do that, to get the 5-FU medication in the blood for a long time, because people take it twice a day, and that way they don't have to have an IV in them. Now, new paragraph as I'm discussing this. There is a variety of how different people's bodies will metabolize drugs. And so some people metabolize it quite quickly, so it doesn't work as well. And other people, they can't metabolize it hardly at all, and it can cause drastic side effect because it doesn't get metabolized. And by metabolized means be inactive and removed from the body. So it can be quite variable patient to patient. There's a standard dose to use in patients that we have from formulas based on sometimes based on the body weight, and it depends on if you give it for a week at a time or 2 weeks at a time. But then knowing that there's differences in there, how do we deal with that issue? So I tell my patients that if they start to get mouth sores or diarrhea or this hand-foot syndrome problem, then we know that that's the amount that we don't want their body to get any more, so that we stop there. If they were supposed to get it for 2 weeks and they get this problem at 10 days, they stop. They're done for the 2 week period of time. They take the week off, and then we reevaluate the next time and probably a lower dose, so we hopefully can get them to take it for 2 weeks if we're on a 2 week schedule. So that way their body can really titrate things with them. The biggest problem I've had over the years, and again, I really talk to my patients in detail about this, but I have some women that say, you know, I can tolerate it. I'm tough. I can tolerate it. My hands are sore, but I can do a bit more. And those are people who really get in trouble, because then they get sores on their feet, they get infection on their feet, and then they've lost 3 or 4 weeks because they have to get those to heal up. Or And when this drug was first started, they get terrible diarrhea, and they really get lose a lot of fluid there and actually die from the process because of all the inflammation to the GI tract from the medication. So what we do, so for different people, if I have people who are getting hand-foot syndrome and diarrhea on relatively low doses, I still know that in that person it's probably an effective dose against their body and hopefully against their cancer.
Excellent. Thank you. And so the important thing is to really be very honest with your healthcare team about what you're experiencing. Very important. Thank you. I want to thank our speakers. You've been an extraordinary group of speakers, a wonderful team, I have to say. And I want to thank all of you who've queued up for questions, both on the phone and online. I want to remind you that this is a one-hour program, and that we know that in planning a program like this, that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. And so with that in mind, again, I just want to reiterate that although the program will soon end, the services that you can access from Cancer Care are endless, and they are free. And you can call us at 1-800-813-HOPE if you have a question, a concern, and if you need any of our services. We have a wonderful staff of over 40 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we're really here to help you in every way possible with practical and financial assistance to counseling and support groups, materials, educational materials, and these, of course, workshops as well. Most importantly, as we're about to conclude, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with metastatic breast cancer and coping with cancer in general. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support, and we're here to help you, and we are simply a telephone call away. So I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop. You may disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.